Welcome back to Decouple. Today I'm joined by mon ami, François Morin. François is a early guest on the Decouple podcast. I think that was even before we were up on YouTube. So François, the guests will get to see your beautiful face. But we had a really wonderful episode, again, in those early days of Decouple. I think it was titled, Is China the Future of Nuclear Energy? You, sir, are, I think, still the World Nuclear Association lead for China. I'll let you clarify that in just a second, but we had, just a great episode. Went a little bit into your past. You know, you're a fascinating person, at least to me, speaking fluent Chinese and Russian and French. And I think we'll send people back to that episode for, you know, more content there, because I'm so eager just to get a sense of what is happening in China, which really seems to be the place that is moving most rapidly, or where there's the most developments happening, whether it's just pure pace of deployment, whether it's deployment of new technologies, molten salt reactors, high temperature gas reactors, the small modular reactor, the ACP-100, which I think is probably the most advanced in terms of a grid connected small modular reactor. So François, thank you so much for making the time and joining us again.
Thank you, Chris. Good morning. Thank you for having me again. I think it was 3 years ago, yes, that we had.
That
was.
I think so.
Early COVID period. I was in France at that time because of the COVID. Now I am back in China.
That's right. And you, of course, introduced me to François Percher. We had a great episode on the preconditions of the Mesmer plan. So just to kind of steer some of our listeners to the earlier catalog, you know, we're 233 episodes in. So for people that have joined recently, I always like to give a little recommendation for something to dig up in the past. So François, it was 3 years ago. So give a brief introduction of yourself. Feel free to sort of draw on some of your past. I find you to just be an absolutely fascinating person. I'll pass.
That's probably simpler than what you may imagine. I'm a senior engineer, graduated in physics and mathematics and thermodynamics. I worked in the French Atomic Energy Commission in a research department for my short thesis about biology. I was working in biophysics. Some other episodes, I joined the nuclear industry and I worked in the design of reactors in France. And I was particularly in charge of the so-called post-Chernobyl studies. And then I moved to nuclear medicine for a while before doing other things, big projects, infrastructure project in Africa, in South America with Chinese. And finally, I joined 12 years ago in the World Nuclear Association in Beijing.
Wonderful. And so François, again, I'm trying to sort of think back to our first episode, and I think it's useful to our listeners to have a bit of a framing of the context of nuclear energy in China. Something that sort of most stuck out to me was just the sort of pragmatics, the rationale behind the pursuit of nuclear energy in China. Something that you said again that stuck out was that the majority of the coal reserves are in the Northwest and a lot of the population is in the Southeast. I think something like 50% of all rail traffic in China is moving that coal towards those population centers. And that was one of the big drivers. Can you talk about some of those historic drivers and maybe the more contemporary drivers as you see them now?
As you talk about coal, just let me say one word about that. We've seen this year again a significant increase in coal use in China, you know, plus 4.3% or 4%, which leads also to an increase in CO2 emission by nearly the same amount. The thermal electricity in China grew by 6.5% last year, altogether. Wow. I mean, gas plus coal plus oil. So these things are not changing. I mean, this is the background. And whatever the hope is to go as per the new governmental instructions and Mr. President Xi Jinping instruction to reach or to target zero carbon in 2060. We don't see yet the carbon peak, which is targeted by 2030. We don't see it arriving. So on the contrary, we see only rise. Regarding this you mentioned the geography of China, north and south. China has consumed last year 4.6 billion tons of coal, of which 550 million were imported. And they were,
wow.
Yes, and they were imported from the south of China, from southern countries like Indonesia. Australia, I don't know, I didn't see the numbers, but they were imported from Indonesia. So you see, China is even importing coal. It's importing 65% now, nearly, of its oil consumption. It's importing nearly 60% of its gas consumption too. China produces a lot of gas, but it's just barely enough to fulfill half of its needs. And this figure is not getting better. I mean, in a sense, it's not getting more Chinese. It's just getting every year worse and worse in terms of the ratio of imported things. However, yes, China is a strong now manufacturer, exporter of energy or energy-related things, like a solar panel and wind turbine and so. The most impressive thing from the last year is the investment in so-called renewable and new energies. They name that new energies. Altogether, electric cars, batteries, turbine, a little bit of hydro, and solar represented 800 billion euro of investment last year. The solar itself represented maybe 10%, nearly 10% of that. 80 billion US dollars were invested just in solar panel and solar systems. It was an increase of plus 50% compared to the year before. It means that now they have how many? I forgot exactly. They installed 60 gigawatt of solar electricity last year, and now the total capacity of solar is around 609 gigawatt of solar capacity installed. Can you imagine that?
Wow!
And still, solar represent only a tiny percentage, of course, of the production, 3.3%.
That's unreal. Okay, so if I can try and summarize some of what you've said, huge capacity additions we didn't actually talk about nuclear so far, but we'll get there, I'm sure. But in all sort of traditional forms of electricity generation, as well as the renewables / new forms of generation. And no real progress towards the climate goals, towards peaking of emissions in 2030. I hear a lot of analysis. There's certainly a lot of breathless optimism about the pace of renewables deployment in China. It seems like the overall percentages, as you said, are not changing massively. It's not that solar has gone from being, well, correct me if I'm wrong, maybe it's not gone from being sort of like 5% of total generation up to 20 or 30 as it is in some places, say in the US or Australia. It's increasing, but everything else is increasing as well. So there's not a huge sort of relative change, or am I off on that?
Nuclear is increasing significantly. Of course, we have between the production and the construction and the production, we have 5-6 years difference. So what we see today in terms of electricity production reflects what the decision taken 5-6 years ago in terms of construction. But still, we had a small growth of nearly 4% from 1 year, from 2022 to 2023, in nuclear production. But it stays at 5% of the mix, as you say, we don't see any possibility to go beyond this 5% in the coming at least 5 years. The target, the Chinese...
Because everything else is growing so much.
Everything is growing. And what is funny, for instance, is when you consider the the amount of data, the electricity demand for the data centers in China is growing not faster, but nearly the same pace as nuclear electricity. So the more we build nuclear, the more we are maybe able to follow with the data center's new requirements. But that will not, it will not replace or challenge the other needs that are fulfilled now by thermal or hydro. So it's a very challenging thing now. However, you must not forget that first, the governmental target is to reach 15% of the electricity mix by 2040, let's say.
From nuclear.
Maybe a little bit earlier, maybe a little bit later. So 15%. And even without considering the future, if you look at the map of China, you have a big province. The nuclear is all on the coastal area. And we have provinces with 100 million inhabitants, or 60 million or 80 million inhabitants, as big as countries. And in these provinces, the nuclear share in the mix is 12%, 20%, up to 25%, depending on the province. So Chinese know how to have a relatively high percentage of nuclear in the mix. You know, it's not something we should not get stuck on this 5%. You know, that's true for the whole country, but there is a large part of it which has not yet considered nuclear.
So just to clarify, the relative proportion of solar and wind, have those increased, say, more than the relative? You said nuclear sort of stayed stable, about 5%. Have the relative contributions of wind and solar increased? If so,
yes.
By kind of how
yes,
much?
Yes, the wind contribution increased by 9%. And the wind is nearly, it's not twice, but it's 1.9 times nuclear in terms of production. And solar is below nuclear. But altogether they make 2.5 times nuclear.
Right. Because, you know, I think one of the concerns with intermittent sources is at certain levels of penetration, they start to cannibalize each other's values and start to impose excessive costs in terms of grid services and transmission, et cetera. From what I understand, China's still at a relatively low, despite the absolute numbers there, you know, what was it, 60 gigawatts added this year, it's still at a relatively low proportion relative to its dispatchable forms of electricity. Is that correct?
Yes. The overall capacity is now it's nearly 3,000 gigawatt. Yes. So if you add 60, you have the proportion. Yeah. It's 60 over 3,000.
So I think what you've painted here for me anyway is a real problem of energy security. Importing that amount of oil, I gather a lot of it's from the Middle East. We're seeing Israel and Iran launching attacks at each other over the Straits of Hormuz or over the Persian Gulf anyway. So that 65% dependence on oil, a real concern. Similarly, gas. I mean, very interesting that they import a significant amount of coal. I guess probably a bunch of that is met coal as well as just their thermal coal. But one of the things I've heard is that, you know, the big drive, and I understand the penetration of electric vehicles is quite high in China. A big drive for that is to diminish dependence on imported oil and try and become more energy dependent more broadly through electrification to, particularly in the oil front, try and reduce that dependence. Is that jive with your sense
yes,
of things?
This makes sense. I mean, it's common sense. However, when you look at the real picture, if China wants to electrify more its energy system, so it might have twice as much electricity generation in 2050 compared to now. So multiplying all that by two is an enormous challenge, you know. So if particularly if you
want, but you're in China right now, just anecdotally, I mean, I hear that there are a huge amount of electric vehicles being put on the market every year in China. Do you see that out on the streets? Is that contributing to improved air quality and things like that?
In big cities, yes, of course, we see now. And they have quite an efficient system. You know, the taxi drivers, they don't charge their batteries. They go to the garage and they take a new charge battery against the empty one. I mean, not all of them, but many of them do that. So it works. They don't feel the shortcomings of the electric vehicle because they are not concerned by the charging. Regarding private cars, of course, they must charge at home or in some dedicated places. It's big numbers, but still only for the big cities.
In terms of some of the changes maybe since we last spoke 3 years ago, and I really want to get into what's happening with deployments inside China, the rate, the pace, the reactor technologies that are being chosen, et cetera. But before we do, China, is it starting to emerge as more of a nuclear exporter so far? I think we have some reactors exported to Pakistan. I'm not sure about anywhere else, but it seems like with such a bustling industry and with this kind of geopolitical soft power that being a nuclear exporter gives you, China is very ripe to move into that market. Are we starting to see that happening?
Yes, China exported successfully to Pakistan already years ago and intends to do more. One important for them target was UK for selling their Hualong model. They spent a lot of money and time and energy in getting the GDA, General Design Assessment, approved by the UK government, as they were somehow promised that they would get after their financial involvement in Hinkley Point. They might have this opportunity to get the site Bradwell for building two units. Betting on that, they prepared all the documentation. They spent maybe, I don't know the figures, something around £20 million or maybe £30 million in 4 years' work, 4 years and a half. And then they were kicked out. So they have been very, very disappointed. Regarding other places, they have, they tried they went all around the world. In Africa, in Kenya, in Eastern Europe, in Ukraine, in Romania, in Czech Republic, but they were slowly also somehow kicked out of this, at least in European side. They had also another target in South America, in Argentina, but with the new president now, we don't believe that the conditions are good for having the confirmation of the Hualong project in Argentina. But who knows, but it may change rapidly also.
I mean, so you've been around long enough to remember the Cold War and remember the different blocs and the non-aligned countries. It sounds like we're emerging into a new multipolar world. It's kind of along similar lines as that old Cold War with Russia and China being the powers that are sort of I don't want to say in opposition necessarily, but the world's divided again along pretty similar lines, and China's not finding its way into Western or Western influence markets. So it sounds like it's going to be more Africa, some parts of South America potentially, but it does sound like a little more constrained.
One interesting remark regarding this energy war now, which is a consequence of this new Cold War. Sometimes you can see in the newspapers some comments on the Russian gas and oil sold to China at a discounted price because Russia would not have any other solution, any other market. I disagree with this point because China is in extreme need of gas, for instance. According to all forecasts, by 2040, China alone could swallow all Gazprom production. It would just fulfill its national need. So there is, maybe there is no, from the Russian point of view, maybe there is no competition outside China, but China itself is so much in need. I believe that till today, China is more in need of Russian gas than Russia is in need to sell its gas.
It was very interesting. I had, I'm going to butcher his last name, Stefan Stepinski on. He's a Bloomberg gas trading journalist, or journalist on the gas markets. He's written some great threads, particularly on Japan, and just seeing some sort of visualizations of kind of the octopus tentacles of the Japanese energy strategy in terms of all the places it imports its gas from, its coal from, et cetera. China, you know, again, getting back to this energy security question, is vulnerable in terms of moving a lot of Persian Gulf oil, I mean, out of the Persian Gulf, but also through the Straits of Malacca, the island chains, you know, in the South China Sea as a zone of conflict, but very easy, you know, just geographically. I was reading a great book called Prisoners of Geography, and it really explains why countries pursue the strategies that they have and make the territorial grabs they have. And it's not because of the whims per se of a you know, particular political figure. It's just basic geography. I mean, you want to control the highlands or the sources of the great rivers. So you go and you make sure that you have it in Tibet rather than the Indians, for instance, or the Russians, you know, being so concerned about Ukraine and those kind of northern plains that sort of leave an unobstructed entry point into Russia. And similarly, you know, Chinese, you know, security imperatives to control that, I think it's called like the first island chain, and control the South China Sea. That's, you know, from a geopolitical perspective, that's to be less vulnerable to naval blockade. There's a few sort of straits that they can move through, I think, between Taiwan and one of the Japanese bases, Okinawa, where the U.S. military has a big base. I mean, there's all sorts of surface to ship missiles systems all throughout there. I mean, China is really hemmed in and really vulnerable, I think, to energy blockade. So I think that speaks to like why there's such a strong Russian Chinese alliance building, you know, in this new pipeline, the Trans-Siberian pipeline, I believe it's called.
Power of Siberia.
I just love understanding.
Yes, power of Siberia. Yeah. They will double it in the coming years, and still it will represent only a tiny portion of Chinese consumption. Of course, geography plays a role outside China, inside China too. You know, they had some plans, for instance, 10 years ago to increase, to double the hydro capacity that was 300 gigawatt at that time. But now, after thorough consideration, investigation on the capabilities offered by rivers and mountains, you know, to get hydro power. In fact, it seems that the highest limit is 500 gigawatt. And today, China has hydro capacity of 422. So they are getting...
So 80 gigawatts remaining.
Yes. So it's why they cannot count on that. And this is all these gigawatts are produced in the west part of the central west part of the country. I mean, it's full now, and so they have to find other means.
While we're on the topic of geography, water cooling for thermal plants seems to be an issue in the kind of more arid interior of China. And I think that might be, again, why they are pursuing some alternative reactor concepts and designs. Can you speak to that?
I don't think it's a question of water cooling. I think it's more because they know how to have now these towers and there are enough water resources. Not enough for hydro, because it's not the lack of water for hydro; it's the lack of mountains, which is. But for cooling the plants, it's not the question. The question is the fear of release of radioactive material. This fear was became very very sensitive issue after Fukushima, The population is so numerous on the downstream of potential sites that because of that, they fear that if any piece of water would be contaminated, then they don't know how it would be managed.
It was very interesting seeing China's diplomatic objections to the Fukushima water release. There was some data looking at some operating Chinese nuclear plants that were releasing far greater amounts of tritium into the water. So, you know, that was interesting, and kind of attitudes towards radiation in China. That's a kind of interesting topic in terms of, you know, it seems like that's kind of receding as a fear in the West right now, paradoxically maybe, but it's...
They will use again for in the coming years, this question of Fukushima, post-Fukushima water, you know, just to put to throw a stone in the Japanese garden. But I believe the Japanese garden can stand more stones. it's even a specificity of Japanese gardens. No, I think they will also build nuclear plants inland, because the number of sites, if they want to reach, let's go to some figures, not briefly. Now we have 57 gigawatts of nuclear capacity. We have no settled target for 2050, but there are many rumors, options, discussions to go up to maybe 500 gigawatts of nuclear capacity by 2050, which is more than the whole world today, which also means that it would consume the whole more than the 65,000 tons uranium that are consumed every year today in the whole world. But even if they don't go as high as that, let's say if they target 350 gigawatt plus 30 gigawatt for heating dedicated reactors. But even with 350 gigawatt of nuclear capacity, this cannot be reached with the coastal sites only. You have 47 coastal sites and approximately the same inland. We have already these 57 already installed capacity. In some sites, you can have 6 reactors. In some others, you can have only 4. So all that considered, the coastal sites cannot exceed 250 gigawatts approximately. So this means that they definitely need at least for 100 gigawatts build reactors inland.
And I mean, we have the example of Palo Verde in the U.S., a reactor in the arid deserts of Arizona. Well, I think actually 4 reactors there. So certainly it's been done. I guess the question is, does that require light water reactors? Does that require, you know, different coolants and moderators? Or you said there's enough water and
yes,
we can build
no water.
Light water reactors.
Water is not a problem. I would even say that there is too much water. It's the threat is much, it's more the flood than the lack of water.
Right.
But no, the question is just a question of safety. But provided that it's guaranteed that there will not be any radioactive release, even in case of accident, then they will start. It has been advocated this week again by several important people to start building inland reactors. After Fukushima, they stopped. It was officially said that they would consider after 2020. But now it's 2024, so they must rush to get some installed before 2030. I believe that before the end of the year, there will be the first authorization for starting a reactor on inland site.
Got you. Yeah, I was just on the World Nuclear Association website looking at the China China webpage. Excellent resource, I must say. But yeah, you see this real kind of exponential curve, sort of 2010s to 2020s, and then it kind of slumps. And I guess that's because of the kind of Fukushima hangover. And we're probably going to see another exponential sort of hockey stick coming very, very shortly. So, I mean, things are certainly humming along. You know, in my brief kind of review of the history of Chinese nuclear, really a buffet lunch of reactor technologies and vendors that that were selected, the Americans, the Europeans, the Canadians. I think the only countries that have not sold reactors to China, probably for historical geopolitical reasons, are Japan and I think Korea. But you could fill me in on some gaps there. But it does sound like China is indigenizing technologies, becoming fully sufficient, self-sufficient in those technologies. And it seems like we're narrowing in on two sort of contenders for the kind of future, at least gigawatt scale light water build out. And those are the Chinese AP1000 and AP1400, which is a derivative, and the Hualong One. So I'm very interested in first, maybe clarifying my initial statement there in terms of characterizing the buffet lunch of the history of Chinese nuclear deployments, and then yeah, where we're going and which technologies are emerging as kind of the standardized nuclear plant for the future builds.
The decision to have diversity in technologies was taken in 2007. The Chinese plan was first to work with the French in the 90s, in the last century, 90s. The first plant, the first reactor started and connected to the grid in China was a fully Chinese reactor. So they might have gone this national way all the way right to now. And there are some Chinese people who say, I mean, experts in nuclear, who say we should not have bought this Western technologies. We should have gone our way. The Hualong itself, which now seems to be important in all the plans, and we have 11 Hualong under construction today, 11, and 4 operating. So it seems very important. But it started also 12 years ago. You know, the design and all assessments around the Hualong, it started many years ago. However, the decision was taken, yes, to have a very diverse origin of the reactors. But it's the same in Finland. Finland, which is a 6.5 million inhabitants, has also 3 or 4 technologies. So they have opted first for the French, then the Kendo and the Vivyar. Don't forget the Russians. We have 4 operating plants and 4 under construction. The AP, the famous AP1000. And their own new options like the CAP1400. Yes. All these reactors are now either working, either being under construction. Regarding a new CANDU, I know that Canadian are somehow positive about the possibility to sell the new CANDU reactor, which is has been agreed in terms of development with China already some years ago, the ACFR, whatever. I don't see that. I don't see the room for it in the current picture. But it's still possible. I know the French also would like to sell more EPR. Now they have 2 EPR in Taishan site in Guangdong province in the south, and they still hope that they can sell Taishan 3, Taishan 4 as EPR. I don't see such a Chinese decision soon. I may be wrong, but I don't see
it. Right. Okay, so let's unpack that. I mean, first off, maybe just kind of rapid fire questions here because I don't want to dwell too long on any of them. But you said the first Chinese reactor connected to the grid was fully Chinese indigenous technology. Was that based upon prior US or French
technology? 300 megawatt. 300 megawatt, which was started in 87 maybe.
Wow. Okay. Let's kind of fast forward then. So the EPR and AP1000 experience in China, like looking at the median build times, you have, I think there's 2 reactors that were built on a shorter time schedule in terms of shovel to breaker connection. But, you know, waving my little Canadian flag, the CANDUs did pretty well, I think, third and fourth quickest deployed at, you know, 4.5, 5 years. But the median build time in China is 5.5 years, and the AP1000 and EPRs took just under 10 years. So why is EPR not being pursued, and why is the indigenized AP1000 continuing to be deployed?
EPR and AP1000 were a competitor in 2007. And there was an official bid at that time, a national tender. And the AP1000 won that. So it makes sense now to see that they have more AP1000 than EPR. I would say that the two EPR in Taishan were given to the French as a compensation to have lost the tender. So, I mean, there is not much more interrogation about that. Now, if you look at the price per kilowatt, for instance, the Chinese yuan per kilowatt, the AP1000 are more expensive than the EPR. You have a kind, yes, you have a kind here, maybe a kind of a smaller scaling effect, which is not very often seen in nuclear, but we could consider, yeah, that the difference of price between EPR and AP1000 comes from this scaling effect, which works here.
Just because the EPR is massive, yes. It's 1750, yes. Versus the AP1000's 1100. Yes. Is it the largest? Is it the largest reactor like ever built?
But they have.
So that being said, though,
they have their own.
There's not plan, any
also Chinese, which comes from an evolution of the AP1000, and that he's fully Chinese, entirely free of intellectual property rights to Westinghouse. And which is 1,500 megawatt, roughly. But there is a new version, which is to come after the first two under construction now in Shidaowan base. And the new one might be 1,700 megawatt.
Okay, just on that topic. Okay, so just to kind of maybe wrap a bow on that, there are not any new EPR reactors planned, despite the lower per kilowatt construction costs, is what I'm hearing, at least compared to the first AP1000s. But there are, the Hualong and AP1000 seem to be emerging as the kind of standardized down selection. How many Hualong are being planned? How many CAP1000s or 1400s are being planned right now?
How many Hualong plan? There are maybe altogether, we see, I told you, 4 now working in operation. 11 under construction, and maybe behind that we can see 30. So that would mean between 45 and 50 Hualong at the end of the end. AP1000.
And what about the cap?
Yes, AP1000 will remain below that. AP1000 had this market perspective to have a lot. Like 70 units in China, that back in 2012, it was the forecast. But now, no, nobody can believe that. And we more expect something between 14 units, 1-4, and 18 units maximum.
So the Hualong sounds like the winner here, and the Hualong is based on the French three-loop design. Is that the kind of origin
story? Yes,
in terms of
global, yes, it looks like somehow, yes, but with new features, including of course the passive safety system, which requires a lot of additional concrete and steel, 50% more, 50% more.
Because this is, without going too off track here, my understanding of kind of origin story of the EPR is that this was, the European pressurized reactor. They tried to harmonize lots of different regulations in Europe and ended up with the harshest regulations from each country, leading to a design that is harder to build, has more concrete and steel involved, double containment, I think 4 trains, et cetera, safety trains. And that's a criticism that I hear. I mean, and we haven't seen, and we're going to talk, I think, a little bit about negative and positive learning rates, but it seems to be a reactor that's been difficult to construct. I mean, the AP1000s in the US, also quite difficult, but I think much more economical in terms of concrete and steel, et cetera. Do you see that? Is that an accurate portrayal, or am I way off?
Not fully, as I just told you that in terms of cost per kilowatt, EPR is cheaper than AP1000. So yes, the construction time here maybe plays a role, but not that much. You know, when your reactor is supposed to work 80 years, 60 to 80 years, you know, 5 years delay or plus or minus is not really significant.
Something you can say in China, I think, that you cannot say anywhere else in the world right now, or certainly yes. In the West.
But look, the AP1000 construction time is quite high, 107 months, 9 years and 2 months in average. So, and it has not seen a significant decrease due to learning aspect of the construction. The Haiyang, the Sanmen 2, I must double check, the Sanmen 2 was maybe a little bit shorter in time to Sanmen 1, but not really much, because they had this primary pump problem and they had to sell the primary pump back to the US and get a new one, and this happened several times. They lost time in this particular case. The Hualong compared to the EP1000, the Hualong is a 82 month construction time. But here also you have an interesting feature. The first two Hualong made by CNNC in Fuxing site just across the Taiwan Strait. This one have been much shorter in construction time. Than the Hualong made by CGN in southern China coast. And those required nearly 1 year more. So, and the second unit was not shorter in time compared to the first in both cases.
So this goes against all of the aspirations that we hear. You know, in the West, we have commitments now to triple nuclear energy by 2050, coming out of a COP declaration by, I think, 30 nations that signed. Interestingly, I don't think China was a signatory to that particular declaration, but they're the most credible to actually deliver and maybe deliver that all sort of in country. I'm curious about that, about this phenomenon that we see of actual negative learning rates. And we would think, I think, in China, with a really teed up supply chain, everything that we're sort of lacking in the West, or maybe what France had in the 70s and 80s, that those ingredients, those core ingredients, seem to be there in terms of a large and highly qualified workforce, whether that's craft labor, engineers, project managers, et cetera. And what you're telling me is we're still not seeing much in the way of positive learning, and certainly not consistently. Like, one thing I've heard is that sort of on site, you know, if you build several reactors on site, typically you see a cost reduction. I guess you have some counterfactuals there, but you don't necessarily see that between sites or between states within a country or between countries. But let's dive a little bit into this question.
You may have, yes, on one side, you may have a kind of a learning effect which applies for the cost. Yes, maybe. Why? Because you mobilize less. Probably you need less capital, maybe, for all the cranes, all the infrastructure, everything which is around. Yes, but even on one side, you don't see, as I just told you, you don't see a decrease in terms of time. Construction time remains the same, or even higher.
Why? That makes no sense. Why?
because it's not a play. Learning effect exists in many industries. In oil industry, in car manufacturing industry, in plane manufacturing, of course, it makes sense, because all these things can be. I mean, that sometimes they require a big infrastructure, but this infrastructure can be cut into pieces, which is not the case in a nuclear plant. You have an extremely massive amount of concrete. You have the of course the steel, but you have also extremely heavy equipment. So you must have dedicated crane for each for moving each equipment. Sometimes you have to build the cranes in order to to move the equipment on site. And it's why, for instance, moving one crane to a site is considered as a nuclear news. You know, they moved the crane on the Sanmen 3. the thing is too big to be to take advantage of any kind of learning effect, and is extremely site dependent. Operations go, and of course, on they follow a planning schedule, but unexpected things happen all the time. You know, the weather is not what you wanted. The transport of the equipment is not what you expected, and there is no way to control that. There is no way to make to make it modular. We have a kind of modular AP1000. Yes, okay, but still, 10 years construction.
I mean, to be charitable, it sounds like, and we've really deep dived this question, and we do have the beauty of having a sort of case control study, the U.S. versus China, where you don't have, you do have a strict regulator in China, but it's not quite the NRC. You don't have the aircraft impact assessment rule. You have a very, highly skilled project management workforce and craft labor workforce in China. You don't have that in the States. And yet Vogtle took 10 years, maybe 10 and a half, and Sanmen, et cetera, the sites in China took 9.5 years. So the common denominator seems to be that the design wasn't finished. Now the design is finished. Some people say, okay, well, you can move quite a bit of the AP1000 construction, into more of a factory environment in terms of creating those modules. So we should see a significant change without all the design reviews and changes. Do you share that optimism, or you're smiling?
Yes, so, I smile because I think the key in this Chinese speed, if there is a Chinese speed. Because even in China, construction time are rising instead of decreasing.
Rising.
Yes. If you take all together, the AP1000, the EPR, the Hualongs, and you compare the construction time today to what it was before, it has just increased by 20%. So yes, even in China, construction time is increasing. And
okay, so there's this.
It's not a question of design.
Go ahead,
the solution is. The capital, how much money do they put at the beginning from scratch, not only on the site to build for the concrete and steel and construction, but also for the equipment. I have seen several times myself in several equipment manufacturing company factories in China, equipment finished already, equipment that cost tens of millions of US dollars each, or like the steam generator for the CAP 1400. I don't know, but the cost, they didn't disclose to me the cost, but it may be something around 30, 35 million US dollars. And these two steam generators, for instance, in this case in Shanghai, they were lying in the factory. They were ready. Can you imagine that? This 70 to 80 million US dollars stock here, immobilized here, and without getting their return, without being fully sold.
Because they were waiting for something to happen on the critical path of construction.
Because they were launched early in advance.
Ah, okay.
But the launching of a big equipment requires is extremely capital demanding, and we don't accept that in the West. We shall not launch in advance the construction of a big equipment. We shall not mobilize tens of millions of US dollars if we have no clear agenda, a clear schedule in which we would at least minimize the number of months or years. In this case, it was years. But the Chinese, they can do that, yes. So they lose in terms of profit, but they can do it, yes.
Okay, and what you're saying, though, is we're still seeing a 20% increase in schedule over the last few years. Like, is that driven by the AP1000s and the EPRs that took 9.5 years? or are we seeing Hualongs, or, you know, I'm trying to think of a stable design that's been around for 10 or 15 years. Are those reactors also starting to take longer to build?
Yes, Hualong is also today still 6.5 years. It's more than the supposed 5 years. It's close to 7 years.
So you got
to
go back.
It's 7 years.
If you want to build something fast, you got to go back to CANDU, it sounds like. I'm just kidding, maybe. Okay. I mean, this is interesting. I had a guest on recently. He had a brilliant quote. I've been trying to find the source of it. He said it was Euripides. But he said, you know, the quote is, you know, man is blind until he has a metaphor, or I guess an allegory, that allows him to see. Right. And, you know, nuclear is just so different and distinct. And I think a lot of errors in terms of how we think about it occur because of the metaphors and allegories that we apply, the category errors that we make. And so one of the famous ones I think about is the Silicon Valley tech investor who is a techno-optimist, has made a bunch of money, is turning to more, aspirational goals of fighting climate change, and says, wow, there's so much potential here in nuclear. There's so many beautiful narratives. There's so many ways that this technology can address all of its problems in terms of proliferation and waste. And I've disrupted a lot in Silicon Valley. I'm a tech disruptor. I'm going to come to nuclear and do the same. That's kind of one category where you apply, a career in tech and think that is applicable maybe to nuclear. I try and, you know, struggle to find, you know, imperfect, but maybe superior allegories or metaphors for nuclear. And what I come back to is, you know, nuclear is a lot like hydroelectricity. Big capital, high risk construction project with a, high value asset, but valued over many, many decades, that can underpin a lot of, you know, economic well-being, that produces cheap power eventually. And obviously there's differences in terms of the operation of a hydroelectric facility doesn't require, you know, a workforce of hundreds. But I find that to be, especially in terms of wrestling with these considerations of, you know, how much can we speed up construction schedule? What are some of the hard limits, or what are some of the limits imposed by the characteristics of the technology itself? Hydroelectricity and nuclear seem to be sort of the closest, at least within that narrow frame. Still very imperfect metaphor, allegory, but probably superior to a lot of the ways. Nuclear is not like a gas plant, not like a coal plant,
No, it is not. And you're right. I even would push the allegory further. I would say, yes.
Sure.
I would say nuclear is closer to a road construction, to bridges and tunnels. You expect a tunnel to be built in, 1 year. And then all of a sudden, there is a big part that you could not guess because of the geology, and it needs new tools and new equipment. And then, you lose 1 year. That's nuclear is closer to that. Nuclear has nothing to do with airplane industry. Airplane industry, you put pieces all together, like the chairs inside, you don't have this kind of, you cannot split the nuclear, even if AP1000 tries to make that modular, but this so-called modularization is still extremely huge pieces, of metal, and so it cannot be compared, yes, with gas plant. Gas plant is just a Lego kind of pipes.
Yeah, I mean, so I'd like to expand on that question of modularity, because that's really been pitched as sort of the salvation of the nuclear industry, or the way to speed things up. And I think it's compelling. I mean, move the higher percentage of work from a unproductive construction site to a more productive factory site, where the labor costs drop, where you can have more efficiencies that are built in if you have enough orders to justify, module factories and module assembly plants, et cetera. What are your thoughts about, the panacea? I'm not trying to frame the question in that way. What the promises of modularity in nuclear? Because certainly they have been made. They've been tied basically to small reactors, but that's certainly been something that's being chased. The CANDUs at Qinshan, for instance, were open top. There's a lot of modularity involved in that, and maybe that helps explain the fast construction time. What are your thoughts on modularity?
It's a project to have modularity for small modular reactors. But I saw interesting thing that a few months ago when Exim Bank in US decided that they would afford long-term loans for SMR construction, long terms of 20 years and low interest rate. this will be the key for building SMR, not the modularity, the low interest rate and the long-term loan. It's what the Chinese do. And it is the key. The key is in the money. Now regarding the technical modularity of, as I think we already talked about that last time, I forgot, but for me, the key in SMR, yes, M is modular, is nice, is beautiful, but the M for modular will not work without an M for many. If you don't have an order of 20 or 30 at once, what will be modular? Your design will be modular, but your construction will be one by one, you know? And how do you get 10 orders at once? How do you get that?
Especially if the sticker shock of the first of a kind or the third or fourth of a kind is you know, these are going to be more expensive than gigawatt scale plants on a per megawatt basis. So that's something, and especially first of a kind designs, and they all are first of a kind designs at this point. And, you know, maybe that brings us to talking about the ACP 100, the Chinese small modular reactor that's under construction. Just seeing some pictures and videos, this thing still looks like a massive plant with a small reactor pressure vessel. Like, it doesn't seem like they've scaled down the civil works all that
much. It's what the Chinese tell me. You know, they said me, I didn't visit it yet, but I'm supposed to go there someday. And they told me, hey, don't expect the thing to be small. You know, it's 15 meters high and it looks big. In fact, it doesn't look much smaller than the neighboring Hualong, and maybe smaller than the Hualong, but not than the CPR 1000, for instance. So yes, the ACP 100 is a so-called small reactor. It will be connected to the grid by probably early 2026.
And what's the rationale there? Is this to start powering Chinese military bases in the South China Sea? I mean, that's still a pretty large reactor for that. So, like, where are they thinking of deploying this? Why are they pursuing a small reactor in the setting of, you know, these extraordinary additions they're planning up to, you know, hundreds of gigawatts more nuclear?
This ACP 100 is not the only Chinese SMR design. Even at the IAEA, there are 10 registered different Chinese design for SMR. And if you add on the top of that, the dedicated to heat production SMR in China, you have that makes at least 14 different designs. So 14 SMR in China. Yes.
And SMR for district heat makes you need a smaller reactor. It needs to be sited closer to a population center. The megawatts thermal are still quite a lot, even in a 50-100 megawatt reactor. Like, it seems like that is really the bull's case for SMRs, as SMRs for district heating.
It is the same as in the US. It's replacing the coal plants, particularly in the north. And the coal plants, as you said, is they are in the cities. So if you put an SMR in a city, or very close to a city, you need to be absolutely certain of its safety, that you will not need to evacuate the whole city. So the question of the EPZ, emergency zone, is very important here. I know that the countries are not binded by the IAEA recommendations, which is to have this 5 kilometers emergency zone for evacuation and so. I know that. However, the countries follow the recommendation of IAEA. And so this problem of putting SMR on coal sites, on coal plant sites, this will be solved only when some countries, like the US, which has already gone through this step, but plus China, plus maybe another country, plus the IAEA, if they come to a consensus. And this consensus still today, even if the IAEA is working positively on that, but it still seems to be remote enough from now, because it's not in their IAEA mentality. IAEA does not consider the design. IAEA considers only the quantity of radioactive material. So,
right. And sorry, so these coal plants that are looking to be replaced, they're district heating coal plants or are they power generation coal plants?
For both, you're right. If it's only for a kind of what they name a pool reactor, they have four different designs for a pool reactor by different companies in China. So you have uranium in water, the water gets hot, and you you supply it, I mean, through one single loop at 90 degrees centigrade, roughly. So it's
that's got to be cheap. That sounds cheap. Yes, like pool reactors, not very expensive.
It's cheap, but Chris, it doesn't work in summertime. So it's same shortcoming as solar panels, which do not work at night. So this heating reactor.
Well, you don't need it in the summertime. It's not that it doesn't work, but you just don't need it.
Yes.
Opposite problem, but still a problem.
Yes, opposite problem, sure. But similar. I mean, yes, yeah. So this is a big concern for the profitability of the thing. You know, the right is cheaper, but it has to be half cheaper, not a little bit cheaper.
So again, just to sort of try and pin you down on what the Chinese SMR strategy is.
Competition. You know,
there's probably some more kind
it's
of
competition.
What's that?
The key is competition. You know, four companies
in terms of international markets.
No, between themselves.
In terms of international markets,
between themselves, four companies, and each of them having two or three designs.
But like, why is China looking to deploy SMRs if they're saying we're going to add hundreds of gigawatts of nuclear capacity in China, which is a country with incredibly huge demands, big population centers? You know, like I understand in the West, there's a rationale for pursuing small reactors, and that's, you know, big time social license. It's we're never going to get governments to pony up billions of dollars. It's, you know, frankly, a lot of it is social license related. I mean, maybe that's the case in China, but I'm curious, like, what is the use case in China? You mentioned district heating. That makes a lot of sense to me.
District heating, that would be for small power reactor. Yes, of course, less than around 100 megawatt thermal. Yes.
So what are the other use cases for SMRs in China?
They have remote places in China, you know, from Tibet, okay, Xinjiang, gotcha, to Gansu. Even in the south, in the mountains, you have many, many remote places where it's difficult to bring electricity, at low cost. And you have also islands. And yes, you mentioned, including the military ones, yes, in southern China. And you can also have this modular type of thing by piling reactors as the for the high temperature reactor.
The micro.
Yes, yeah. No, the high temperature reactor is 200 megawatt, but they intend to have three times the same reactor in one more compact unit to have a 660 megawatt reactor in the future. So they are used, yes, individually for remote places, for also exploration sites in the sea, in the South China Sea. It's not very deep. The water is not very deep, and they have many projects of oil extraction on the coast bordering Vietnam. It's in dispute, by the way, with Vietnam, but they intend to get this oil out of the sea, and they need electricity for that. So they may have floating kind of plants.
I mean, it's so interesting because in the West, we're in this phase of just imagining all these applications. We're trying to chase climate change solutions, looking at nuclear to do things like process heat, to you know, get remote communities off of diesel, you know, barge-based nuclear for, you know, a variety of those kind of applications, you know, advanced nuclear concepts. And that's all in our imagination. It's all in our head so far, basically. Even grid-scale SMRs, you know, potentially Ontario will lead on that. But China is in an active process of actually doing all of these things. So maybe just touch on the high-temperature gas reactor, the molten salt reactor, barge nuclear. I mean, there's like, we could talk for hours and we won't be able to today, Francois. I'll have to have you back, but maybe just catch us up on those few things.
So, yes. So your question is about a high temperature reactor. Yes. This one was a kind of, it was developed by Tsinghua University, and it was not supposed to be on the market at that time. The first studies considered that the HTR kilowatt would be much higher in price in terms of cost than the rest, and that the LCOE might be 18 to 20% more expensive than the other standard PWR. So, but after all this consideration of carbon reduction, all of a sudden we saw that heat is a good thing by itself. Heat has value, so the HTR become after it started construction. You know, it started in 2007, but after it started construction, the project was, but the FCD must have been 2012, I think. Yes, 2012. But anyway, at that time,
that's the first concrete pour.
Yes, for the HTR. Mm. And nobody had in mind the value of heat. It came afterwards. And now we consider that, yes, there are a lot of industries that could take advantage of such heat, particularly, yes, in coastal China. We have many chemical industries and so they could get this 500 and something degrees for their chemical processes.
Okay, so I'm trying to wrap up a few other loose ends that we had. So one question, again, regarding the Hualong versus Chinese AP1000 rivalry. I'm wondering if part of that is affected by export controls. I know that China negotiated with Westinghouse and, you know, got fully licensed in terms of, I think, domestic deployment of AP1000 and its derivatives. But I think in 2018, Trump put in, the Trump administration, put in restrictions on exports of the Chinese AP1000, AP1400. I imagine that's, you know, would be disputed, and that would be less of an issue in a Chinese aligned kind of country than, say, Poland or somewhere else, where frankly it's just not going to happen. Is that a reason for the pursuit of the Hualong to have something where there's, you know, no real export limitations beyond just this kind of new Cold War? Or what do you think?
Chinese construction company are on the blacklist. Yes, definitely. So this is a problem. But would it prevent, from, for instance, Turkey from buying it? I don't know. Maybe not. Yeah. Even if Turkey is in NATO, Turkey has bought a Russian VVR, and Turkey might as well buy a Chinese CAP-1400. It's still possible.
Okay, and just, you know, one last, I guess, maybe concluding question, and we're going to have you back to deep dive a few of these topics if you're willing, is, you know, I think like the all-time sort of world record for construction speed, you know, per megawatt capacity are the ABWR builds in Japan. As I understand it, very modular reactor, and the Japanese just, you know, knocked it out of the park. I forget which site, if it was the one that begins with K that I can't pronounce. I think like the aspiration, the hope is, you know, could we develop in a variety of countries the capability to deploy as quickly as the Japanese did with the ABWR? What was behind the speed of deployment, and is that replicable outside of Japan in the 1990s?
I don't know well the Japanese case, to be honest, but I think we should not be extremely focused on this construction time obstacle. If the Chinese, for instance, if they deliver the authorizations for 6 to 8, or maybe more, 10, up to 10 FCDs a year. So this is the main thing, you know. Can the Chinese supply chain, the Chinese construction capability, can they have this plus 10 reactors a year? Today, yes, they can. Today, each component can be manufactured by 5 different companies in China. So there is not much problem. But if we go from 5 plants a year, 5 reactors a year, to 10 reactors a year, then the overall construction capability must be multiplied per 2, regardless of the speed. You know, the speed is not the main problem. The main problem,
if you have low cost capital, that is a big proviso.
Yes. But the physical capability today do not exist to sustain the construction of 10 reactors per year. What exists can make six reactors per year, but 10 would be that mean it would mean that you might have 50 reactors at the same time under construction. 50 reactor, yes, with the same, let's say, few handful of companies. No, it cannot be done. Yes, you must. They must have a little bit more of the supply chain. They must increase the capacities of the main manufacturers, which are in Shanghai Electric, Dongfeng Electric, Harbin Electric, in different places in China. But also the construction, concrete and steel and experts in nuclear construction. Yes, they must be multiplied per two.
So China's this, like, again, fascinating case study of, you know, all of the optimism and aspirations of the West are being tested in China.
Exactly.
In real terms, being exposed to the, you know, hard conditions of reality. Like, is there anything that's not running optimally in China in terms of its nuclear sector? Because we have this access to low cost capital, we have this ramped up supply chain, we have incredible craft labor, lots of tacit knowledge. I understand probably there's romanticizing some things, but like what is yet to be optimized in terms of this? And this is way too broad of a question as we sort of close out this interview, but are there any things that stand out?
Maybe a better collaboration between the Chinese governmental institutions, that the State Council wants to have 10 reactors per year authorized. In 2022, they gave their stamp for 10 reactors. In 2023 also. But in both years, we've seen only 5 new FCDs. So, and why? Why there is such a discrepancy between the theoretical authorizations and the practical authorization? Because of the autonomy, and it's a good thing. It means they are reliable, of the NNSA, the Nuclear Safety Authority. The Nuclear Safety Authority has no any other agenda than guaranteeing safety. So they want to take their time by investigating every aspect of one new specific project. So you see, time is also here. Time, it doesn't start. Counting time doesn't start when you put the first concrete. The time starts when they think about giving or not giving authorization. You have already this limit between the 10 approved, the 5 started, again 10 approved, again 5 only started. So we are losing years already. 2 years are lost here. Whatever is your construction speed. So, but I think it's. I was interviewed years ago by CNN, who asked me if we would be all confident of construction in China, because they told me, we've seen so many schools which fell down during the earthquake in Sichuan in 2006 because of the bad construction quality. Could the same happen with nuclear? So thanks to this limited speed of authorization, I think we can be confident that this will not happen in China. Yes, we can trust the construction quality.
Okay, one last question, and I do promise that this will be the last one, but it's not a short one to answer. With this proposed scale, and listen, we see all the time, commitments to building hundreds of reactors, and that often doesn't actually come true, or a tiny fraction of the aspirational goal come true, whether that's JFK calling for 1,000 reactors in the U.S., or I think the initial Mesmer plan called for far more than 56 reactors. Leaving beside those examples and the reasons for them, fuel, is that something that's going to start to become a constraint if China does get to, say, 350 gigawatts capacity of nuclear by 2050?
If China gets...
And does that mean...
Yes.
What are the solutions there? I mean, China doesn't have massive uranium reserves. Does that mean they start looking at breeder reactors? What's like the long, long-term prospects for China? Talking like 2050s out, what are the constraints? Is it fuel the big one?
I don't think so. They have uranium might be a constraint, yes, but not the fuel fabrication. They are increasing now all the capacities in terms of enrichment and conversion. They have a lot of reactors that are supplied by the supplier, by Rosatom, by the French, by EDF, by so for the first loads at least. And they are learning how to make all the fuels for the VVR, for the CANDU, for the HTR, for the EPR and the AP1000. They know now how to make. They have not the full capacity in terms of number, yes, per year, but they will get it to be
just in terms dependent. Just in terms of having enough uranium fuel. Like, I mean, this is a common sort of anti-nuclear talking point. If we were to scale nuclear up by X amount, we only have 60 years or 70 years of nuclear fuel. And obviously, that argument doesn't take into account sort of reserves versus resources and unexplored uranium out there. But is there talk in China about, you know, in the early days of nuclear energy in the US, for instance, we thought uranium was quite scarce. Breeder reactors were seen as the future. You know, is this something that's even in the discourse, or it's far enough away that
no. They talk about really yes, no. They have all this in mind. CNNC, which is one of the big companies, they are now investigating how to get uranium out of the seawater. So it means that they are even considering that we might not have enough uranium on land. So yes, why not in the seawater as the Japanese do? However, there are still probably many discoveries to be made in China, because it's a large country with unexplored places. So they might find more uranium. Anyhow, it will never be enough. It will never be sufficient. China, if they are really to make this 350 gigawatt of capacity by 20, let's say 50, of course they need to. They will need to import, same as I said at the beginning, regarding oil and gas, they will need to import more than half of their uranium, definitely.
Okay. Well, I'm just doing the quick back of the envelope math here, and getting an additional 300 gigawatts deployed as 10 gigawatt scale reactors per year. Color me a little bit skeptical. Francois, thank you. This was incredible. I would have loved to have deep dived sort of each of the various themes that we touched today, but hopefully we'll be able to lure you back in a shorter time interval than 3 years. Thank you for making yourself available. I know you're a busy guy, just got back from Kazakhstan, so we appreciate you making the time.
Thank you very much, Chris. Thank you.